From KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. Russia's incursion into the Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula has sparked a reaction across Europe. The region voted over the weekend to secede to be part of Russia, but the European Union, the United States, and others have called that vote illegal. This hour, we'll talk with a KU professor about some of the East-West cultural conflicts that exist in the long shadow left by the Soviet Union, as the Ukrainian conflict threatens to boil over. We'll also talk with a KU grad who's teaching English in Kiev and what he's hearing from average people there. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Up to date. I'm Steve Kraske. The current situation in Russia, Ukraine, and the Ukrainian province, now the supposedly independent state of Crimea, is the result of a complex history in Eastern Europe. When the Soviet Union collapsed in the 1990s, many former Soviet states adopted democracy in place of communism. But as we'll discover, many of those states haven't fully embraced democracy. And a lot of folks who live in Russia, Ukraine, and elsewhere, especially those who remember the USSR, have lots of fond memories, while a younger generation is on a quest for true democracy. With us today to run through the most closely watched region of the world right now is Vitaly Chernetsky. He's a professor of Slavic languages and literature at KU and has been monitoring the official and unofficial media accounts of events in Ukraine. Chernetsky, who was originally from the southern Ukrainian city of Odessa, is an expert in 20th and 21st century Russian and Ukrainian literature and film. He's a current president of the American Association of Ukrainian Studies. And Vitaly, so nice to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, tell us, you're from the Ukrainian city of Odessa. Tell us about that city, Vitaly, and you say it's a lot like a city in the U.S.
Yes, it is. Odessa, even though there has been human settlement there and cities going back to ancient Greek colonies on the Black Sea coast, the modern city dates back to the late 18th century, and it was founded as a commercial port. And it was a city with a heterogeneous mixed population from the very beginning, where there was a very large Greek, French, Italian, and other communities, and also a very large Jewish community developed there by the middle of the 19th century. Mark Twain visited it in the 1850s and described it in his book Innocents Abroad as the most American city in Europe, that for him it felt being like in a Midwestern city just on the coast and with some touches of Russian architecture.
Well, what does it remind you of? What city have you been to in the Midwest that maybe it reminds you of your home city?
It's hard for me to say. Cincinnati, where I lived before moving to Kansas City, is actually more like Kyiv, the capital, because it's very hilly and on a big river, the Ohio. Mark Twain, compared Odessa to Minneapolis, which I'm not sure is quite fair, because Minneapolis is a lovely city, but its winters are very cold. Odessa, however, has a much milder Mediterranean climate. It has a regular planning, so perhaps our neighbors on the other side of Missouri in St. Louis could be somewhat similar.
Yeah. Well, KU Professor Vitaly Chernetsky is our guest. You have family, friends, and colleagues over there. You know, it's just a few hours' drive from Crimea. It's been reported that citizens at Odessa are worrying that they'll be the next front line. So how are your family and friends reacting to Sunday's vote in Crimea, where officials announced that 97% of voters supported rejoining Russia?
Well, a lot of people in Ukraine are really worried indeed that the Putin's government's appetites might not stop with Crimea. Basically, the overall picture is that even if there isn't an outright invasion, that the current Russian leadership wants to turn Ukraine into a weak buffer state and to weaken the central government and to encourage various irredentist movements in the cities where Russian language is the predominant language of communication, such as Odessa and cities in the east of Ukraine close to the Russian border. From what I understand, and my feeling is that of only a very small, insignificant minority of the population actually strongly wants a unification with mm-hmm. Russia, because mm-hmm. they are aware very much of the restrictions and unfreedoms that characterize the current Russian everyday life. However, there have been grudges against past Ukrainian governments about being not very effective, not standing up to corruption. But that was the whole point of the Euromaidan, the protests that began in the late November and continued for 3 months. These were Ukrainians affirming their right to be in a state that lives by the rules of transparent law, which abhors corruption and which promotes democracy.
But lots of folks in Odessa are worried that they, in fact, could be next.
Yes, indeed, because basically one of the parts of the new political doctrine of the Russian government in the so-called near abroad, as they call it, that is the areas of the former Soviet Union, is to assert their right to protect and intervene in the supposed need of protection of Russian speakers or people who consider themselves Russian by ethnicity. And these are not the same categories. There are many people who, due to the history and Soviet policy, who do not consider themselves Russian in terms of ethnic background, are more comfortable speaking Russian as their first language. In general, identity there is a very complicated patchwork of or a layer cake of identification on the local, national, regional, etc. level.
Well, which folks are more nervous, Vitaly, as you look at all this? Is it the folks in Odessa, or are folks in Kiev perhaps also feeling pretty shaky about what could happen next?
I would say, from talking even yesterday to friends on Kiev via Skype, that Kiev is determined and united. Kiev, even though there are two, there's a lot of Russian spoken on the streets, is a city which is very strongly historically Western-oriented and pro-democracy-oriented, and the support of the rank-and-file population over the protests has been very, very strong, where the Ukraine's neighbors to the northeast were sowing more discord are large industrial cities in the northeast and east of the country, like Kharkiv mm-hmm. or Donetsk or Luhansk. And in the south, Odessa, even though it's in the far southwest of Ukraine, pretty far from the Russian border, because it is a historically a predominantly Russian-speaking city, there too have been such elements of discord being sown. So I would say the situation is the most precarious in these large cities.
What do you think is going to happen next? I mean, what's going through your mind as you monitor this situation from Kansas City? Where do you think we're going here?
Well, we certainly have a complete reorganization and redefinition of the global world order. I mean, this would not be exaggeration to say that this is the most serious crisis the world is experiencing since the days of the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 1960s.
Wow. Wow. That serious.
Yes. Well, one should remember that Ukraine inherited, when the Soviet Union broke up, the world's third largest nuclear arsenal, and it agreed voluntarily to give it up completely in 1994. And at the time, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Russia were guarantors of Ukraine's territorial integrity and its current borders, with France and China later joining the same agreement. And basically, the fact that, you know, Ukraine's territorial integrity has been disrupted sends a very dangerous message, a very dangerous precedent on the global scale, that for any country who the world would be trying to persuade to abandon its nuclear missile aspirations, that security assurances provided by the rest of the world might not be worth much, since in the case of Ukraine, they apparently haven't been worth much.
Yeah. Do you expect more aggression from Russia, again, as you watch Putin and what he's saying and what he's doing? Again, what's going through your mind when it comes to all this?
I think there is a test of will on the Russian side. They basically, in a way, testing the Western community of nations to see how strong is their resolve, how organized they are. Can they speak with a united voice? Can they formulate one united, coherent policy? And it is clear, one can see from the perspectives of the rest of the world, that Russia in this is in almost complete isolation. However, the measures that have been proposed by the Western nations,
the economic sanctions, and
yes, you know, they hit small points, but so far they do not appear to be deterring Russia much. So my worry is that unfortunately, the current Russian leadership is prepared to escalate it further.
Wow. Are there protests going on in Odessa, again, your former town? I mean, we hear about protests in Kiev. What are you hearing?
Yes, there are. Basically, in Odessa, like in Donetsk, like in Kharkiv, in these large cities, we have basically situations of two rival protests. The pro-democracy, the protesters or organized rallies of people who are supporting democratic reform integration with the West, they are generally very peaceful. There are, however, smaller and very angry groups who are very much are intent on disrupting the situation. There has been some street violence. Fortunately, in the case of Odessa, street violence has been minimal. And so there is visibility of that. Once again, it is a very small minority of the city's population. These rallies have never numbered more than a couple of thousand of people, but still, it is significant and it is visible.
But I get the impression that your friends and your family over there are very, very nervous right now.
I would say yes. My parents, who still live back there, are extremely nervous. They are worried about their safety. They have lived through a lot. They are now older and retired. I would say that people of the middle and younger generation who are more, associate their lives with the new world after the collapse of the Soviet Union, they are more determined to stand up to things, but they too, of course, are concerned because certainly there is a possibility of the situation of that is going to be really disrupted. And they very much hope that the rest of the world is going to stand in solidarity with Ukrainians who just started this whole process back in November in hope of living decent lives in dignity and in where democracy is respected.
I want to bring our listeners into our conversation. What role should the U.S. play in the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and Russia? And if you're a member of the Ukrainian or Russian community and you want to join our conversation, we'd like to have you. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888. You can also email us to updatedate@kcur.org, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. I want to bring Mickey Caesar into our conversation now. He's an American from Lawrence who received an MFA in creative writing from the University of Kansas. He's a poet, and he now teaches English in Kiev, where he joins us now. And Mickey, thank you for taking some time with us. We sure appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Mr. Kratzky. I'm glad to be here.
You know, we're talking about the tensions in Odessa. I'm wondering about the tensions that you're experiencing in Kiev. Give us a picture of what your friends are saying and what you expect to happen yourself, Mickey.
Well, overall, life in the city, life in the capital is fairly normal as it can be at this point. you know, it's been about 3 weeks since the Yanukovych government was ousted. People are very much interested in getting back to their normal lives. However, the psychological stress of the conflict with Russia, it shows up, and you know there are people that are extremely worried, and mostly one thing to understand is that as Professor Chernetsky said, identities are rather fluid here, and a lot of my ethnic Russian friends in the city, they have family back in Russia that are pressuring them to come back, and there's just a lot of tension and worry.
And when you say the tension manifests itself in some unusual ways, what are you talking about, Mickey?
It's almost like politics is about and all that people can speak about. You know, I teach at a school teaching children ranging in ages from 9 years old until 16, and especially with my older students, they have they're very, very absorbed by the conflicts and the problems. And sometimes, you know, teaching English grammar is not exactly easy when your students are worried about the safety and health of their family and friends.
You talked about some of your students to our producer, Steven Steigman, actually imitating the snipers they've seen around town. What are the kids doing?
Well, it was just rather unnerving. It happened on two separate days that younger students, you know, I walk into the classroom, I just want to greet them, and they're leaning out of windows with, you know, pretending they're holding rifles and shooting people, and I was rather horrified. I'm like, what are you doing? Oh, we're playing sniper. And, yeah, just unsettling.
Because they've seen snipers with their own eyes, perhaps, Mickey?
I would doubt that, honestly. Most of the schools in the area of the Maidan had been closed for about a week and a half to 2 weeks. Where I work is a private school that teaches additional classes. So it's not a public school, and we're about a mile and a half from the city center. And so while students weren't attending their regular classes, they would still attend classes here at this school.
But no question, you're seeing them. They're a little tense. They're excited. I'm guessing all those kinds of things.
Yes, and even although things are fairly calm and normal now, there was really no avoiding it in the week of 18 to 20 February. Mm-hmm. Just not only the news, but well, I don't know how familiar you are with Lawrence, but you can imagine the situation of Massachusetts Street, the old downtown, being the scene of like horrific violence, and living, say, at 23rd in Iowa, you can hear the explosions. Wow. You know, the stun grenades, and some gunfire. And so the students are very well aware, you know, even the young ones, very well aware of what happened, even if they didn't see it with their own eyes.
You were listening to my conversation with Vitaly Chernetsky, again, the professor from KU, and he was saying, he's still with us, he's saying that he very much expects more violence, more aggression from Russia. I'm wondering what your outlook on all that is.
Well, there is a great fear of it. You know, the possibility of military incursions is still there. My personal feeling is that I think the Kremlin would have to be insane to try to take the entire country. Okay, because other than some southern and eastern districts, which, by the way, as Professor Chernetsky said, are not really, even the ethnic Russians are not really thrilled at the idea of being under Russian control, but here from the capital west towards Lviv, this whole part of the country has really horrible memories of Soviet domination and the actions of Stalin prior to the Second World War. And it would be untenable for any Russian commander to think that they could take and hold this country without years of bloodshed.
Wow. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, our email address, update@kcur.org. Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Paul from Overland Park. Paul, good morning.
Hi. I want to make a comment and perhaps you could respond to it. I seem to be very little on the news that I get to see on TV and so forth about the historical situation of the Ukraine, particularly the Crimea, you know, the fact that it was, who knows why, given to the Ukraine in 1954. I try to think of an analogy. San Diego points south being given to Baja California at about the same time with the naval base. Mm-hmm. But also the historical conflict or discrepancy between Catholic and Orthodox East and West, even before the First World War. And I tend to agree with the Ruskies on the Crimea. The rest of the Ukraine, I don't know. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say. Thanks.
Professor Chernetsky, can you give me a little sense of that history and maybe add on to what Paul was saying to us here?
Well, in order to understand what happened to Crimea in 1954, you need to bear in mind that in 1944, Stalin, at the end of the war, deported to Siberia and Central Asia most of Crimea's indigenous population, mm-hmm. the Crimean Tatars, the Greeks, the Armenians, the Bulgarians.
So thousands and thousands of people.
Hundreds of thousands of people. Many of them died in transit. Mm. And the Crimean Tatars, the indigenous population of this area since the Middle Ages, were not allowed to come back until the 1980s. So in some respects, the San Diego analogy is apt in that Crimea is a place which is very heavily populated since 1945 by people associated with the Soviet Navy and retirees of the Soviet Navy. This, however, is, they've lived there now for 60, 70 years, and this is also an area which was a major tourist destination. This is the only part of the Soviet Union which had a dry Mediterranean subtropical climate, so comparable indeed to Southern California. However, it had a very difficult and very complicated history, and it was really devastated both by the war and by Stalin's actions. And it is connected to Ukraine physically. Crimea is not self-sustained economically. It is an arid semi-desert. It gets its water from the Dnieper River through a canal that goes through the isthmus that connects Crimea to the mainland. It gets all of its electricity and other supplies. It has very little to sustain itself economically, except for the tourist industry in the summer and some wine production on the southern coast.
But all this begins to explain so clearly why folks there are undoubtedly just undone by this recent aggression then, right?
Yes, because if a place's major source of economy is tourism, you certainly do not want war and instability. And this is something that has been made, this point has been made very, very strongly. It's a place which all of a sudden was overrun by people in heavily armed people with top-notch weapons, but without any country's insignia, even though it was very clear that they were speaking with Russian accents. And this is not a place that, you know, any tourists, I think, are going to be willing to come back anytime soon. So this is going to be a similar story to other places which were once prized tourist destinations and they're going to become war zones or post-war zones, disasters. Abkhazia, the breakaway region in Georgia, was also one of the pearls of Soviet tourist industry, and now it is an absolute disaster. There are beautiful beaches and palm trees and pretty mountains, but it looks like a war zone.
You know, to what extent, Mickey, have you thought about leaving, pulling up stakes and coming home?
Well, first, Stephen, I'll tell you that my family would be very happy.
I can only begin to imagine, Mickey.
Yes, they'd be very happy if I left, but I have contingency plans. Actually, I feel like there's less chance of me needing them than I did during the government crackdown. Myself and several other expatriates from both Canada, Scotland, and England had made plans to meet if communications, phone, and internet were cut off during the government crackdown.
But in February, you're talking about.
In February,
yeah.
Fortunately, that part didn't happen. I've already told my family to brace for the possibility that if Russian forces do come into Kiev, that it may take me several days to a week to get out.
What's holding you there now?
One thing that I'm sure Professor Chernetsky could vouch for is that Ukrainians are just an amazing people. They are kind and generous. You know, in public, they keep a very stoic face. You know, this is a major city here in Kiev, and you don't expect smiles from people that you just pass on the sidewalk. But as friends, they are generous to a fault. And
sure, give us an example of that, because you had something in your own life not long ago that sort of illustrates exactly what you're talking about.
Well, I recently had a birthday, and I didn't want to do anything for that or make any big deal. But as soon as my Ukrainian friends found out about it, well, at work they had a party for me. My landlord. My rent was due on the same day as my birthday, and when he found out that it was my birthday, he was beside himself for having not brought a gift. And he and his wife the following weekend took me out to see Yanukovych's estate at and I always mispronounce this, Mezhirizhno.
Mezhirizhno.
There we go. Someone with the knowledge of the language better than I. Excellent.
So, Mickey, you're staying because of the people, and I wonder how far that goes with your family back here.
Well, without getting into too deep psychology.
Okay.
I had never taught children before this past fall began, and Just even last week, you know, after the government fell, but before the Crimea thing, one of my 10-year-old students asked me if I was going to go back to the United States. And I told him that I was planning on going back in August. And he started to tear up. And then I realized he thought, you know, with the language barrier, he thought I meant that I was going to go back to the United States forever.
Oh.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so I reassured him, no, I'm just going back to see my family. I'm just going back to visit. I'll be teaching again in September. And he brightened up. And they're like my children. I don't have any children. And, you know, other factors, I've been here for 2.5 years. I have a lot of friends, a lot of people that I really care about. Mm-hmm. I have an apartment. I have a cat.
And the kids you're teaching range in age from what to what?
From 9 to 16.
All right. We go back to some phone calls before a break here. Alex from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi. I just had a short comment and a question that you may or may not be able to answer. I do business with Russia, but as soon as this whole Crimea thing happened, I completely closed down all my business operations there. I can't do business with someone who says one thing and does another, and that leads to the Crimea issue itself, in that they came in and denuclearized and took away their ability to defend themselves, entered into an agreement where they would protect them in case an outside aggressor came in, and then they, as the outside aggressor, came in and took over. So my question is, how can we ever do business with Russia again and believe anything that they say. And I'll take the answer off here.
Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Professor Chernetsky, what do you say to that?
Well, basically, this is what most of the world leaders and prominent people in the global business community are saying, is that we cannot go back to business as usual with the current Russian leadership. And this is a country which now one has to be dealing with at greater distance and with a great degree of care. So the situation is very complicated, and this is a serious challenge for global diplomacy. I am, however, really heartened to see that the U.S. diplomacy, both Secretary Kerry and the United Nations Ambassador Samantha Power and many other people, have been very strong, very thoughtful about this, and they have my full support, and I very much hope that in consultation with the European allies, they will be able to formulate a long-term, thoughtful, consistent policy here.
Okay. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here about Russia and the Ukraine and the escalating tensions in that part of the world. We'll talk about the role of poets, authors, and playwrights there compared to over here. We'll ask Mickey Caesar, how did he wind up teaching English in Kiev to begin with? I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation with psychologist Wes Crenshaw about why girls are winning the gender war, you can find that at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, if the crisis in the Crimea has got you thinking about the Cold War, we're right there with you. We'll talk about the U-2 spy plane incident with the son of pilot Gary Powers. We'll also visit with Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. This hour, we're talking about the tensions between Russia and the Ukraine. We're visiting with KU professor Vitaly Chernetsky. And also joining us this morning from Kiev, Mickey Caesar. He's an American from Lawrence who received an MFA in creative writing from the University of Kansas. Mickey, how did you wind up teaching English in Kiev to begin with? Because I know you have a good story about how you learned about Kiev even as a very young boy.
Okay, well, I hope it's a good story. Well, yes, I had always known about Kiev, and it had a place just in the back of my mind for most of my adult life.
Yeah.
When I was a very small boy, my mother played violin for the Omaha Symphony, and so she had this huge collection of classical music. And oftentimes, when she was playing music, I would hear something that I liked and ask her what it was so I could play it later. And when I was a boy, probably 6 or 7 years old, maybe 8, in the early 70s, I heard one piece of music, and she told me it was Modest Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, and the movement I was listening to was The Great Gate of Kiev. Hmm. When I asked her about it, she just pulled down the encyclopedia from the shelf and said, "Read." And so, yes, very, very pre-internet days. Yes, I had
That's
to read
okay.
the encyclopedia.
That's a good mom you got there.
Oh yeah, and she had other things to do too. But mm-hmm. I spent a good part of my afternoon reading about Kiev and the history of Kievan Rus. Saw photographs, and it was my first exposure to the idea of a different alphabet. And as a young boy, it just looked cool. If you've seen Cyrillic, you know some of the symbols just look really great. Mm-hmm. And and it was also my first knowledge that that there was a split in the Christian religion other than just the Protestant Reformation. And I simply became fascinated with it. And when at dinner that night, my father, who was a colonel in the Air Force, asked my sisters and I what we had been doing for our day, I told him, "Hey, I had discovered this city and I wanted to live in Kiev." And of course, in the 1970s, his response
That's not going to happen.
Not going to happen, exactly. He said, son, forget it. You'll never see that place. And fast forward to the nearest future. After I finished my MFA at Kansas University, I had been picked up at a PhD program, but quickly found myself very unhappy and started looking for a teaching position.
Mm-hmm.
And half serious, but half jokingly, I posted on Facebook, hey, does anybody need an English teacher? And I got a response from a friend who's in Wichita right at the moment, that said, come here and teach. We need English teachers with your qualifications. I can have you working the second you get off the plane. And I wrote back and said, are you in Vienna? And he said, no, I'm in Kiev. And 3 weeks later, I was in Kiev.
Just happened, right? Why not?
Exactly. My family thought I had lost my mind, possibly, but
yeah.
But it's been a good move.
Oh, to be young again and have those kinds of options, Mickey. That just sounds incredible. Back to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888. Chris from Lawrence. Chris, welcome to Up to Date.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call. Hey, greetings from Lawrence, Mickey. And thank you all for this call or this show. I've been really ordinarily really great at absorbing myself in news. I've been on a bit of a news diet lately. And so I'm only picking up bits and pieces of these stories. But it seems to me that, I read in yesterday's Journal World, which was probably the day before yesterday's Kansas City Star, excuse me, but about the celebrations that were taking place in Crimea and by the people, and they were so happy to be part of Russia again, and it seemed to me the whole thing started with a desire to be closer to the EU as opposed to being closer to Russia. I'm wondering what the Crimean people, or those that identify as Crimean, think about it. Is this just a battle of territory, or if it's what the Crimean people really want, then it seems to me it would be contrary to America's credo to become involved at all.
Professor
Chernetsky, people decide what the Crimean people want.
Professor, respond to Chris's remarks. You talked earlier in the show about the makeup of Crimea, but just walk us through some of that again.
Yes. Crimea's situation is unique in that it was depopulated of its original indigenous population at the end of World War II, some of it due to war losses, some to forcible deportations. Whenever I visited Crimea, even in post-Soviet days, it struck me as the most Soviet nostalgic region of Ukraine. And this is something that we need to bear in mind, that the 1990s was a time of great economic disarray when people's salaries were not regularly paid or you were paid in goods. For instance, if you're a winemaker, you got wine in plastic jugs as your monthly salary. Or if you worked in a factory making socks, you got your salary paid in socks. So for a lot of people, memories of the past can become selective. So I think the desire here is not so much to join Russia, but there is a very strong nostalgia for the final decades of the Soviet Union after the 73 oil crisis, the Soviet Union actually got an artificial shot in the arm that can enabled relative stability in terms of consumer goods access. So this is what I think is primarily guiding some of those feelings.
That's going to surprise a lot of Americans. Won't be able to relate to that, Professor. That's going to be a real stretch for a lot of people to hang on to there.
Well, but nevertheless, I mean, we all can relate to the fact that when we were young, when we were 17 years old, the sun shone in a particular way, and we were younger and we were happier.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we need to bear in mind that people's opinions do not form in a vacuum. And the Russian television media and a lot of people in Crimea watch Russian TV channels coming from Russia have been very strongly emphasizing this narrative. Basically, this is part of the media landscape and freedom of speech landscape of Russia, in that the internet is a very diverse and savvy place, and there are some independent newspapers.
Yeah.
But the television is very tightly controlled by the government, and the message is very propagandistic and very manipulative. Some people say to an even greater extent than it was in Soviet days. And this ends up forming people's opinions, because if you hear it long enough on TV, you end up absorbing it one way or the other.
Yeah. Chris, thank you for the call.
Thank you. May I ask another question?
Yes, just quickly, Chris.
Thank you so much. Regardless of the propaganda, you know, all of that aside, and I understand that. I'm no child. I mean, I remember the breakup, and I remember the Soviet Union and diving under my desk just in case a big one was dropped. But regardless of the propaganda, if it's what the people want, then who are we to say that they can't have what they want? If it takes this little piece of territory away from Ukraine, and the Crimean people, maybe they'll decide 10, 20 years from now, oh, God, I really screwed up when I made that decision.
Mm-hmm.
It's what the people, isn't that the basis of
right.
democracy, the message we try to, you know.
I got
anyway.
You, Chris. Yeah, Professor, was it really a democratic vote, as some here question, or what do you say to Chris?
No, this is not what the people want. The last independent poll before the tensions in Crimea began indicated that only about 40% of Crimea's population wanted unification from Russia.
So why
was
the
significant?
Vote, why was the vote then 97% in favor?
Well, because this was not a free and democratic vote when you have guns to their hands, and also there are a lot of irregularities. In the city of Sevastopol, the main naval base, the vote was 123% in favor of joining Russia. If the vote is 123%, then it should
up.
Give the world pause.
Yeah, okay. Mickey, do you want to weigh in here on any of this?
I would agree with the professor as well. You know, I'm probably going to misquote Stalin here, but I believe I'll paraphrase. He said, "It's not the vote that counts; it's how the votes are counted." You know, the final results.
Lyndon Johnson said that once too. Yeah.
Well, good for him, I suppose.
Yeah.
But the final count was 97% in favor.
Yes.
And, you know, the last time I heard that figure, that was Bashar al-Assad's reelection numbers in Syria. You know, when you consider that 60% of the Crimeans are ethnic Russians, 25% are Ukrainian, and 15%, God, I hope I got my math right, 15% are Crimean Tatars. You know, you can see the impossibility of 97%, even if all the Russians wanted that. And you know, to touch on something that the professor was speaking of, this is also very much a matter of the media landscape. Now, most people under 40 tend to have stronger feelings towards Ukraine and also use the internet as their major news source. Portions of the country and older people are much more susceptible to television, and there is that desire for strength and stability that is responsible for some of the reaction in
mm-hmm.
Crimea,
mm-hmm.
You know, the last 20 years have been very chaotic in Ukraine, economically and socially. And the revolutionary government has been portrayed as Ukrainian nationalists, fascists, and neo-Nazis. And so the fear that the Crimean people feel is quite real.
Hmm. That's the voice of Mickey Caesar. He's joining us this morning from Kiev. He's an American from Lawrence who's teaching over there. We're also joined by KU professor Vitaly Chernetsky. Again, our number 816-235-2888. I'm going to go to Harry from Leawood, who has a comment about the election as well. Harry, good morning.
Good morning. Well, my comment is in keeping with the lady ahead of me. I cannot understand how a referendum could be where the entire province, 97% of them, vote for something, could be considered illegal And if this is the will of the people, which it apparently seems to be, are we doing any more than meddling by saying that this was not legal? I just cannot understand that.
Well, Harry, I think the point here is that the vote was rigged, that it was a trumped-up election. Professor, am I saying that correctly?
Yes.
The guns were not in the voting booths, so the people who were in the voting booths had a secret ballot. They still could vote. Even though there was a gun outside, it doesn't make you vote the way the gun wants you to vote once you're in the booth.
All right, Harry, I appreciate that. Professor?
Well, first of all, there was no time for any free discussion before the referendum. There was very heavy military presence on the streets, and for a lot of people, remember the intimidation of Soviet days and remember voting how they were told to vote, which is what happened in Soviet elections up until 1991. Additionally, what is very important here is that the ballot question there was no option for keeping the status quo. Basically, the question was, yes, are you in favor of joining Russia? And no, do you not want to stay with Ukraine? So it was an impossible choice, and it was not in any way legally formulated. There were no independent observers allowed. Journalists were not allowed. So we cannot trust any of those statistics. As I said, the last free and fair independent poll that was taken by a respected polling agency several weeks earlier said that only about 40% of Crimean adult population were interested in potentially joining Russia.
You know, Mickey Caesar, I wanted to get to some of your first impressions of Kiev and how astonished you were by how celebrated writers and intellectuals are over there and the weight they carry compared to the weight that maybe is carried in this country. Tell me a little bit about that. How astonished were you by what you saw over there?
Well, it was really rather simple and just one of these most basic things. But I felt really, really happy when I first came to Kiev because the first thing I noticed, I had arranged to stay in a hostel for my first 2 weeks here nearby the apartment I ended up renting. But it was on Gorkova Street, which was named for Maxim Gorky.
Ah.
And, you know, famous writer. And at the other end of the block, the cross street was Vladistova. And the metro stop that I would use to take the train throughout the city, Plosha Vladistova, is, of course, Leo Tolstoy Plaza. Hmm. And as I got to know the city a little bit better, you know, I came during the dead of winter, which is very dark and very cold, by the way. But discovered that the huge park that was at the intersection of, I'll call them Tolstoy and Gorky, it was named after Taras Shevchenko, the great Ukrainian poet, and it has a statue in the center, maybe 12 meters, 10 or 12 meters tall, of this poet. And the name of the primary university in the country's capital is named after a poet. And, you know, every school children still read and memorize poems as part of their daily lessons. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll have, you know, my school children recite these poems for me and then try, you know, depending upon their language level, try to translate them for me. Mm-hmm. But everywhere you look, there are celebrations of writers and poets. And what is missing is really great monuments to individual military leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of monuments for those who died in the war. All right. But as far as, like, you know, a George Patton highway, you're not going to find it.
Professor, what's your sense of why intellectuals like Jodan are more revered in the Ukraine and Russia than they are over here? Why is that?
Well, basically, there are two things to bear in mind. In the Russian Empire in general, of which a large portion of Ukraine was a part in the 19th century. There was no freedom of speech, and even philosophy departments were banned at universities. So literature became the default place for articulating all sorts of debates. Taras Shevchenko, a Ukraine's national poet whose bicentennial we are marking this month and whom Mickey has just mentioned, he is a great voice of national dignity, and he's a figure greatly revered by Ukrainians. He basically showed this colonized nation that they have a voice. I mean, his role can be compared to people in Lady Gregory's circle in Ireland who gave the Irish their dignity that some of them have felt that they no longer had back in the late 19th, early 20th century. So this is really has been very important. And in contemporary culture, yes, some poets and prose writers like Serhii Zhadan are indeed rock stars in a sense. In the English speaking world, Lord Byron was the last one to be a rock star of this kind back in the early 19th century.
Yeah. Mickey, you read Zhadan over there?
Honestly, I wish I could say I had, but my knowledge of the language Russian and Ukrainian both are rather poor. I hope to read translations in the future.
Yeah,
I can send you a list. There are more translations happening, and this is one of the general problems of the English speaking world, that so little of contemporary literature is available in translation, but there are things if you look a little bit, and I'll be happy to send a list.
Oh, Professor, I'll get you my email address before we leave today.
We'll do that. Well, Mickey Caesar, we sure appreciate you taking some time from Kiev. What time is it there?
It's coming up on 7 o'clock in the evening. It's 6:58.
I was worried I was keeping you up at night, but I'm glad I didn't. But Mickey, thank you so much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, and thank you all as well, Professor Chernetsky.
My pleasure. Thank you so much as well for your comments.
Mickey Caesar holds an MFA in creative writing from KU and teaches English in Kiev. His latest book of poetry is titled If I Were on Fire. And Vitaly Chernetsky is an associate professor at KU and the author of Mapping Post-Communist Cultures, Russia and Ukraine in the Context of Globalization. Thank you so much for your time today, Vitaly.
Thank you for having me here. It's been a pleasure.
You can find more information about all of our broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the show, some more Cold War talk. We'll visit with the son of U2 spy pilot Gary Powers, and we'll also talk with Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.